My name is Daniel Roth, publisher of the American Arts Project. We invited a dozen writers to New York to take part in an evening called Back in the World, Writing After Vietnam. They came from as far as Michigan, Colorado, and Iowa to speak before a standing room only crowd at the Westside YMCA in March of 1984. For many people, the wounds have not yet healed. For over 10 years, the war in Vietnam divided this country unlike anything since the Civil War. All of the writers you will hear on this cassette, with one exception, are veterans, most from the war in Vietnam. The discussion ranges from thoughtful to tense. The readings range from terror to poignancy. We hope you listen to the words of these men and read their novels. The American Arts Project is proud to have been a part of this evening. And now, moderator Michael Stevens.
To my left is Larry Heineman, and next to him is John Clark Pratt, Robert Olin Butler, Peter Rand, W.D. Earhart, and John Del Vecchio.
Of what importance is fiction, especially fiction dealing with Vietnam, to our lives? Can it equal or go beyond the movies, documentaries, histories, and television footage already produced? Fiction about the Vietnam War is a payback to the veterans who wrote it and to the veterans who read it. For the non-veteran, the fiction is an imaginary world which gives shape, order, and form to the individual chaos of this event. Because Vietnam is a psychic wound which still haunts us, it is the inner life of the experience that still needs further exploration, and this journey leads us to the gates of fiction and into fiction's domain. If you want to smell Vietnam, the cordite, vegetal rot, the fish sauces, the human sweat and human rot and the death, the loneliness of an all-night forward observation post, you have to go to the fiction writers. If you want to taste Vietnam, its warm beer, sea rations, red mud, its nectar and its swill, you go to the fiction writers. If you want to touch Vietnam, the black night, the shades of green, the heat you can cut with a knife, the monsoon rain in your face, go to the fiction. If you want to hear it, the creepy, crawly silence in the night, the rounds, gunships, the terrible beauty of someone else's firefight, the rain on a poncho, there you go. The fiction writers. What I am saying here is that the words of these writers can turn your head around. Our first reading comes from Larry Heineman, and in his opening remarks, Heineman addresses the question, hasn't he gotten Vietnam out of his system?
One of the questions that I would like to ask that I am personally curious about tonight is, how many people in the room are veterans themselves? Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much. The Vietnam War, for me anyway, was like and is like having a nail in your head. And it's just, it's a fact of my life that will not go away. And it will probably be a source for my writing for a long time. Certainly, the subject matter hasn't gone away.
Larry Heineman's novel, Close Quarters, was published in 1977, the same year as Michael Hare's Dispatches and Philip Caputo's A Rumor of War. Since 1971, Heineman has taught at Columbia College in Chicago. This excerpt is from a work in progress entitled The First Clean Fact.
Just one thing that you need to know technically in the story. The story is addressed to a man named James. And the story is directed to him just as if in a letter. And where I come from, if you don't know someone on the street, I'm from Chicago, if you don't know someone on the street and you need a match or directions or change for a dollar or where's the bus stop, you walk up to somebody and you say, hey, Jim, you got a change for a dollar, you got a match, what's the time? And James is simply the formal name for it. So that's who James is. James is simply the, as far as I'm concerned, the reader that I never meet. the stranger that I will never know of. Let's begin with the first clean fact, James. This ain't no war story. War stories are out. One, two, three, and a heave-ho. Into the lake you go with all the other alewife scuzz and foamy harbor scum. I live on Lake Michigan. But ain't it a pity? All those crinkly, soggy sorts of laid-by tellings crowded together as thick and pitiful as street cobbles, floating mushy bellies up like so much moldy shag rug, dead as rusty-ass doornails and smelling so peculiar and unchristian. Just isn't it a pity, because here and there and yonder among the corpses are some prize-winning, leg-pulling daisies, some real simple-ass pop-in-the-oven muffins, so to speak, some real softly-lobbed, easy-out line drives. But that's the way of the world, James, or so the fairy tales go. The people with the purse strings and apron strings gripped in their hot and soft little hands denounce war stories with perfect diction and practiced gestures as a geek monster species of evil, ugly rumor. A geek is a carnival act whose whole act consists of biting the head off a chicken or a live snake. They stand bolt upright and proclaim with broad and timely sweeps of the arm that war stories put other folks to sleep where they sit, when the contrary is more to the truth, James. Any carny worth his cash box, not dead or in jail or some county nut house, can tell you that most folks will shell out hard-earned greenback cash every time to see artfully performed and urgently fascinating, grisly and gruesome carnage. Other people, getting witty and spry, floor of the Senate, let me read this into the congressional record, showboat oratorical, slip one hand under a vest flap and slide one elegantly spit-shine wingtip shoe forward ever so clever, and swear and be damned if all that snoring at war stories doesn't rattle windows for miles around, all the way to Picornyville, or so the papers claim. Picornyville is a little bitty town between Wheeling and Half Day. And a distinct but mouthy minority, book-learned witchcraft amateurs and half-savvy street punks and patriots for cash, for some piddling hand-to-mouth wage, James, slyly hang their heads and secretly insinuate that the snoring is nothing if it isn't the apocalypse choking on its own spit, trying to catch its breath for one more go-round. According to some people, folks do not want to hear about the night at Firebase Sweet Pea, the whole company got kicked in the mouth, good and hard, street fight hard, and wound up spitting slivers of brown teeth and mushy scabs for a fortnight. Lieutenant Stennett had us night loggered on a lumpy, rocky slope down the way from high ground, his first, but by no stretch of your imagination, his last mistake. And you could hawk a gob of phlegm and spit on the woodline from your foxhole, James. And it was raining to beat the band, and no one was getting any sleep. And just after midnight, according to Gallagher's radium dial watch, some zonked-out zip crawled up sneaky close in the mangled underbrush and whispered in the pouring rain, "Hey, you, Richard Nixon is a egg-sucking hunk of runny owl shit." Then Paco and me heard him and some other zip giggling, tee-hee-hee-hee, as though that was the world's worst thing they could think to say and would provoke us into rageful anger. Jonesy raised his head from his rucksack where he was taking one of his famous naps, fucking the duck, we called it, and stage whispered back, "Listen, you squint-eyed spook,
You ain't telling me anything I don't know.
Then they whispered back at us with one voice, as giggly and shivery cute as a couple smart-ass six-year-olds, G.I., you die tonight. And then giggled some more. Paco blinked his eyes slowly, glancing at me out of the corners as if to say he didn't believe he heard what he knew he heard, and wiped the rain out of his eyes and said out loud, "What the fuck do these zips think this is? Some kind of chicken shit Bruce Dern, Michael J. Pollard, John Wayne movie? G.I., you die tonight. What kind of a fucked up attitude is that?" Then he leaned over his sopping wet rucksack in the direction of the smirking giggles, put his hands to his mouth, megaphone fashion, and said, "Hawk shit," loud enough for the whole company to hear. "Put your money where your fucking mouth is, slowped," he said, "whipping on me." And later that night they did. They greased half the 4th platoon and Lieutenant Stennett's brand new radio man, and we greased so many of them it wasn't even funny. The lieutenant got pissed off at Paco for mouthing off and getting his radio man blown away so soon, but that was okay because the lieutenant wasn't wrapped too tight, as Jonesy would say. The next morning we got up, brushed ourselves off, cleared away the airstrike garbage, the firefight junk and the jungle junk, and dusted off the walking wounded and the litter wounded and the body bags. And the morning after that, just as right as rain, James, we saddled up our rucksacks and slugged off into the deepest, baddest part of the goon-gone forest north of our base camp at Fuckluck, spelled P-H-U-C-L-U-C, looking to kick some ass. Anybody's ass. Can you dig it, James? And take some names. We hacked and humped our way from one end of that woods to the other, feeling no more sophisticated or complicated or elegant than an organized gang. Looking to nail any and all of that goddamn giggling slime we came across to the barn door. Then one bright and cheery morning when our month was up, Private First Class Elijah Raintree George Washington Carver Jones, Jonesy for short, James, had 39 pair of blackened, leathery, wrinkly ears strung on a bit of black camo wire and wrapped like a garland around that bit of turned-out brim of his steel helmet. When we finally humped through the south gate at Fuckluck, you should have seen those rear area motherfucking house cats bug their eyes and cringe every muscle in their bodies and generally suck back against the buildings. You would have been right proud, James. Jonesy danced this way and that, shucking and jiving, juking and high-stepping, twirling that necklace to a fare thee well, shaking and jangling it as much as a necklace of ears will jangle, James, and generally fooling with it as though it were a cheerleader's pom-pom. And the Fuckluck base camp Viets couldn't help but look too. And James, don't you know they were Viets during the day and zips at night? One zip we body counted one time couldn't booby trap a shit house any better than he could cut hair. Every Viet in the place crowded the doorways and the screen windows and such as that, gawking at Jonesy. And us too. And the rest of the company, what was left of us that time, had to laugh, even though we humped those last 300 meters to the tents, up an incline, on mushy, bloody blisters with our teeth gritted, and the fraying rucksack straps squeezing permanent grooves in our shoulders. A body never gets used to humping, James. When word comes, you saddle your rucksack, take a deep breath, and set your jaw good and tight. Lean a little forward as though you're walking into a stiff and blunt nor'easter, and begin by putting one foot in front of the other. Then, after a little while, you've got two sharp pains, straight as a die, from your shoulders to your kidneys. But there's nothing to do but grit your teeth a little harder and keep humping. Swear to God, James, those last uphill 300 meters were the sorriest, goddamnedest 300 motherfuckers in all of Southeast Asia. Captain Courtney Culpepper, who never missed a chance to flash his West Point class ring in your face, that ring the size of a railroad watch, never once offered to send the trucks to meet us at the gate. Said we had humped that far, might as well hump the rest. Thank you.
An excerpt from Larry Heineman's The First Clean Fact. John Clark Pratt is the author of The Laotian Fragments, a novel set in the broader theater of the Southeast Asian War. Raised in Connecticut, he has degrees from Dartmouth, Columbia, and Princeton, and was a Fulbright scholar as well. Pratt's observation about facts and fiction concerning the war is quite revealing.
This experience for me is one of the most exciting that I've had as a writer. Some of you, very few of you, maybe one or two of you might know that I wrote a book about Laos. And as such, it has not been included on the Vietnam lists because, as everybody knows, that was another war and had nothing to do with Vietnam, which is a bunch of bullshit which anybody who knows the story can tell. I'm fascinated with the concept of fiction as it reports fact. And I think what we have in common as writers of Vietnam fiction is that it is easier to tell it like it was by writing fiction than it is by writing fact. There was some very good, quote, factual, unquote, material that came out of the war, but some of that is just as fictional as the greatest fiction that we have all read. And those of us who served in Vietnam know that what we saw passing in front of us every day was often hard to distinguish. Was it fact or was it fiction? And when we read the newspaper reports of what we had just done, we found that we were reading more fiction than not. Or when we found out such aspects as motives or good guys or bad guys or denouements, we suddenly came to realize that in fact the Vietnam War was being conducted, reported, and understood the way people used to write traditional novels. They created climaxes and endings. They created victories and defeats. They created good guys and bad guys and characters and the whole lot. So I think if you want to find out what Vietnam really was, you've got to read the fiction because there are too many conflicting facts. So I think for that reason, fiction is better. Bill Earhart, however, is a poet as well as a fiction writer, and you'll get the chance to hear Bill. What do you think the difference is between fiction and poetry? Do you see any difference, Bill, in translating the subject, because you've written both, in fiction and poetry?
It's really hard to answer that because when I sit down with a piece of paper, I've never really decided I'm going to write a poem or I'm going to write a story or something like that. Up until fairly recently, within the last 5 years, every time I've sat down to a blank piece of paper and picked up a pen, it's ended up being a poem. I think probably in my poetry I use a great many of the elements of fiction. You know, the rule that I've always used with writing a poem is that experience always gives way to the poem. That is, you may have a particular experience that I want to write about, and as I begin to write, I begin to realize that the poem is trying to go somewhere else besides the literal experience that generated it. And every time that happens, I will always give way and follow where the poem wants to go. And I think fiction writers do that too. But it's really hard for me to say. Especially because I'm not really a fiction writer. I mean, you've read the so-called fiction I wrote, and essentially it's me talking about what happened. I think your explanation of the nature of the war was really good because, for me, the experience was so bizarre, I couldn't imagine a plot or characters that would be any more, you know, why invent them? There they were, I lived them.
John Delvecchio was doing a lot of research, and those of you who know his 13th Valley, if you can figure out what's fact and what's fiction in that one, good luck. Maybe John wants to talk to that.
Well, in the 13th Valley, there's a lot of documentation. Let me just kind of come at it from a different angle. The motivation for myself for writing the 13th Valley was that I felt that the story, the infantryman's story, the soldier, the Marine's story, what was being told just didn't have anything to do with who we were and what we were doing over there. What I was seeing in the press, and I think one of the final things that really kicked me off into starting to write was seeing Apocalypse Now. And I remember there's one scene there, a scene at the bridge, and the bridge is all lit up. It's a night scene. And they lit it up so the NVA could rocket it, so they know just where to land the rockets. And I think it's Martin Sheen, I believe, is the actor. And he's coming up the river on this riverboat, and he comes up to this one black GI, and the guy is obviously stoned out of his head. And he says to him, "Who is in charge here?" And the soldier says something like, "Nobody's in charge here. You want to be in charge." And that particular image of who we were in Vietnam and what we were doing over there, I think, is the image that most Americans in 1975 or 76 had. And I know that was one of the things that really upset me, and I was trying to set the record straight, and I didn't believe that you could set that record straight, that you could correct the image of who we were and what we were doing over there without doing a lot of documentation also, because the documentation lends a certain validity to the fiction itself. Sometimes, if you're writing just fiction, well, certain people will read it and believe it, and certain people will read it and won't believe it. And so I felt that it needed that base, that base in fact. And so one of the things that I did was I took an operation that I was on, and I got the actual operation reports, the after operation reports, lessons learned, and five or six other documents that were involved in that, and rebuilt the story as I had remembered it, trying my best to follow the actual operation, and I had the real, the original maps, so I was able to follow it on the maps just as to what was happening, and it's for that reason that it is so real, because although the characters are changed, they're composites in many ways, the operation is real, and again, I think that was very important.
Does anybody think that there will be a big Vietnam novel, the novel of the war?
Well, Norman Mailer had to sit down and find the language to write his book and tell his story. And his story is not the story that I or anybody that I know wants to write. I'm much more interested in the spirit of the experience, in the spirit of the war. It was evil and mean, and there was no redeeming. Nothing redeeming about it, and don't let anybody tell you there was. We went there for evil reasons, and we performed an evil, and millions of people are fucked up because of it. And, well, pardon me. But,
Robert Olin Butler, on the other hand, says his novel, The Alleys of Eden, isn't necessarily a war story.
Cliff's thoughts now stayed with Fleming. Even on that first day, Cliff felt a link to the captain. Fleming was Cliff's contemporary, only a few years older than Cliff, and Fleming's seriousness about his job, about the Army, included a strong sense of protective comradeship that Cliff found in many of his superiors. It was the one thing that he'd least expected about the Army when he'd gone in. It was the one thing that touched him the most. He saw briefly the face of the first sergeant in his basic training camp, a black man rumored to be the third most decorated man in the world. The man spat and swaggered and bullied the trainees, but Cliff helped bring one of the trainees, who had a badly broken leg, into the orderly room, and he saw the first sergeant examine the leg with gentle hands, with his brow and eyes pinched in deep concern, and the first sergeant raised his hand to let the trainee grab it as the pain twisted through him. The first sergeant's gestures, his looks, were subtle, but they were terribly clear to Cliff, and Cliff felt a brief but strong bonding there in the orderly room, the boy with the broken leg, the first sergeant, Cliff, and the other trainee who'd helped bring the boy in were all fused together in that moment.
Bob Butler, a former interpreter for the mayor of Saigon, is fluent in Vietnamese. During the war, he worked with military intelligence. These days, he works in Manhattan, writing his fiction on the Long Island Railroad. This unusual method has paid off. His books include Sundogs, Countrymen of Bones, and The Alleys of Eden, from which he read.